And welcome to Tom Hartmann University, our book club. And today we're reading from Ralph Nader's Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think. This is from page 74, the chapter How the System is Rigged. According to Russell Mokaber, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, quote, corporate crime takes far more lives, causes far more injuries and diseases, and steals far more money than street crime. But the vast amount of law enforcement resources, mass media attention, and prison cell blocks are devoted only to street crime. Just consider these preventable casualties. Almost 60,000 annual workplace-related fatalities from both disease and trauma. 54,000 deaths a year from air pollution. Over 100,000 lives lost as a result of medical malpractice. Nearly 100,000 lives lost from hospital-induced infections. Over 100,000 fatalities from adverse effects of drugs. And over 40,000 deaths every year due to inadequate or no health care coverage for diagnosis, treatment, and medication. There are far larger numbers of sicknesses and injuries attached to these data sets. These statistics have haunting human faces. Children, women, men, and families destroyed by uncontrollable, monetized minds. Whether they are caused by recklessness, criminal negligence, or worse, the key factors in common are the preventability of such pain and the suffering inflicted from commercially induced neglect, predation, manslaughter, and homicide. By comparison, street and home homicides do not exceed 14,000 lives lost annually. Now see how companies have made sure they have the laws that they need to go after you, and how they make sure that the law can be used as their punisher. The giant multi-tiered home mortgage business, now driven by the same one percenters who profited from crashing the economy in 2008, can nail you if you misrepresent information on your mortgage application. Suppose you say you're going to occupy your house as a principal residence to get a lower interest rate and down payment, and you don't for some reason. Lenders can call the loan and demand repayment if the mortgage balance is outstanding. Absent that payment, the lender can seize your home, foreclosure. In addition, by claiming you committed bank fraud, these companies can use the FBI against you. As the veteran housing columnist Kenneth R. Harvey warned, this can trigger severe financial penalties, prosecution, and prison time for ordinary Americans. But how many bankers feel the cold metal of handcuffs tighten on their wrists when their crimes rob American families of their homes and life savings? Health insurance companies have similar supporting laws to deny medical coverage by alleging illegal activities. This could mean anything from non-disclosure of traffic violations to gun accidents, even when there has been no conviction. It could mean something as vague as hazardous behavior, according to the New York Times. If a company paid you and comes back for their money, they can get you prosecuted for fraud. These corporate Goliaths are too big to fail. If they know how to enact laws, they know how to enact laws to make sure that you are too small to stop them. Corporate state culture, the plutocracy whom oligarchy is given an astonishing exoneration, so long as it claims that violence and mayhem are not their direct purpose, but an unfortunate byproduct that just couldn't be helped. Like when innocent people are accidentally killed by U.S. drone attacks, the government seems to quietly get a free pass. It's almost as if corporations get away with a permanent defense of an institutional insanity, a defense going global in terms of deadly supply chains, from horrific African mines to dangerous factories in China, in India, and Bangladesh. Deoxygenation and poisoning of the vast oceans, estuaries, rivers, and lakes, upping greenhouse gases into rapid climate destabilization, extending the range of infectious diseases due to habitat and ecological disruption and desecration, and changing the nature of nature itself through unregulated genetic engineering and nanotechnology. Even with 6 million slow, agonizing deaths a year globally attributed to the tobacco business, cigarettes are still demonically promoted by one percenters who reap staggering profits from selling their addictive and poisonous product, especially in developing nations where regulations protecting children do not exist. The excuse is forever that corporatists have no intention, knowledge, or reason to do harmful things. The institutional insanity defense, again. Or the manufacturers of weapons of mass destruction, whose militant advertisements say they are just helping the national defense, but are not at all responsible for their product's use in the coercive policies of empire and perpetual war. Is it institutional madness or infantilism? Did the World War II allies let the giant Krupp works in Germany get away with this excuse after the war ended? It's time for people to take away these rationalizations of omnicide from corporations that demand they be legally privileged as persons for their pursuit of profits, but not as persons for our pursuit of them as criminal predators and refugees from justice. In the 2012 U.S. presidential campaign, Republican nominee Mitt Romney asked about corporate personhood, replied that it was a given, saying, "Hey, corporations are people, my friend," like it was a science fact he learned in fifth grade. This is no mere thought throwaway line. Billions of dollars of litigating, advertising, marketing, and corporatist commentary have been focused on driving this people image into our minds from childhood. Regularly, full-page ads show that Goliath corporations like Walmart or Lockheed Martin are just people like you. The ads are filled with pictures and names of the faithful workers who bring you goods and services. The book by Ralph Nader, Breaking Through Power.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, well, as Richard Nixon said,
if the president does it, it is not illegal.
Actually, if the president leaks, it actually isn't illegal. Maybe we should do something about that. There's something bizarre going on here. There's something very bizarre going on here that has to do with Donald Trump and his, I mean, this, I'm speaking obviously of his meeting with the Russian foreign minister and Russian ambassador, in which he apparently started bragging, and this story hit the news yesterday after we got off the air, as I recall, where he was bragging about,
"I get the best intel. I got the greatest intel. Oh, hey, you want to see some of the really cool intel I got?"
I mean, apparently that was the context, right? You know, and now he's, so then he sends three of his people out, including McMaster. I mean, you know, his director of national intelligence and his security chief, his CIA head. You know, he sends out all these poor schlubs who, you know, are like at the highest level of the federal government and our intelligence to say, this was all done. Actually, I'm kind of conflating two stories. This also goes back to the, you know, why did he fire Comey story, the Clinton thing. But he sends out McMaster yesterday, who says, well, you know, the president did not compromise methods or persons. There's a technical phrase for it. I don't have the story in front of me here. I printed it, and I have no idea what happened to it. In fact, I'll bet it's actually in Victoria's Muse here. But in any case, he says, he goes out and says, no, you know, first of all, yeah, McMaster, at no time were intelligence sources or methods discussed, and the president did not disclose any military operations that were not publicly known, said General McMaster. He called the Washington Post story false. And then Rex Tillerson said the same thing. He said that Trump talked about the nature of specific threats. That may come back to haunt him. But this is from Victoria Jones's newsletter. But according to the officials, Trump discussed the contents of the intel, not the sources and methods used to collect it. Now, in other words, he didn't say, you know, a spy named Victor in some city in Syria told us that there's this group of ISIL guys who are planning to smuggle. Who are planning to smuggle bombs concealed as batteries in laptop computers onto airplanes, because it appears that that's kind of the thing. You know, that's the you know what they were actually discussing. Although a lot of this is speculation, we don't have the transcripts. So Tillerson comes out, McMaster comes out, one other, I think it might have been Sean Spicer, comes out and says, "Oh, you know, this is all a big, you know, not a big deal." And, you know, he didn't really, release any important information, and, you know, et cetera. But this one guy, Tom Bossert, who is the Homeland Security Advisor, who was either in the room or knew people in the room, called the directors of the CIA and the NSA immediately after this meeting and said, oh, my God, Trump, you know, shared this information. You know, and it's not just he shared it with the Russian ambassador and the Russian foreign minister. I mean, it could have been the Israeli ambassador and the Israeli foreign minister. It could have been the French ambassador and the French foreign minister. It doesn't matter. Well, I mean, it does matter because, you know, we've got stuff going on with Russia right now. Some good, some bad. But, you know, there's certainly a lot of mixed stuff, shall we say, going on. But the bottom line is that Donald Trump seems to be like this child who and he's releasing information that can be relatively easily, apparently, if this news reports are to be believed, the ones in The Washington Post, The New York Times, can be reverse engineered to figure out who is that spy. Who is that guy who has embedded himself in ISIS and is sneaking us information who Trump just outed? Now, Trump's defense is, hey, you know, I did this with a foreign power that's working with us to try and stop ISIS. And, you know, truth be told, the Russians have a big ISIS problem, too. But still, this is not, I mean, this is nuts. This is nuts. I think, you know, David Brooks, I've spent much of my, 14 years on this radio show or thereabouts, 15 years on this radio show, actively disliking David Brooks. He's a conservative columnist who writes for the New York Times. And particularly during the Bush years, he was always, you know, out there defending Bush and the war and all this other kind of thing. It's just, but he has a column in today's New York Times, When the World is Led by a Child, that I think should provoke some serious thought for all of us. He says, mentally, Trump is still a 7-year-old boy who is bouncing around the classroom. Most of us, most adults have learned how to sit still. Trump's answers in these interviews are not very long, typically 200 words at the high end, but he will typically flit through 4 or 5 topics before ending up with how unfair the press is to him. His inability to focus his attention makes it harder for him to learn and master facts. And that's his first critique of Trump. His second, most people of drinking age have achieved some accurate sense of themselves. Trump apparently has none. I'm not quoting David Brooks here. This is just, you know, Trump is constantly looking for reassurance, constantly looking for reinforcement, constantly looking to people to tell him who he is. And, you know, we can play Sigmund Freud and say, oh, it's because his parents basically abandoned him when he was a child, but and therefore he'd never really developed an internal sense of who he was, other than deference to authority figures, because he went to a military school as a child. But, I mean, he's here, David Brooks, he says, in a short period of time, I understood everything there was to know about health care, he told Time magazine. A lot of people have said that. Some people have said it was the single best speech I ever made in that chamber, he told the Associated Press about his joint session speech. By Trump's own account, he knows more about aircraft carrier technology than the Navy. According to his interview with The Economist, he invented the phrase priming the pump. It was Franklin Roosevelt, actually. And he didn't invent it. He just popularized it in the context of economics. And then Brooks points out this, you know, Trump is not only trying to deceive others. His falsehoods are attempts to build a world in which he can feel good for an instant and comfortably deceive himself. I absolutely agree with this. Never thought I'd say that about a David Brooks column, but I absolutely agree with it. And I think it's something that we need to concern ourselves with, and we need to concern ourselves with seriously. Whether it's dementia or whether it is, and perhaps even just, you know, age-appropriate dementia, whether it's a guy who believes that your body is like a battery and it has a certain amount of power, and when you exercise too much, you know, Trump, now this is hitting the news, Trump has famously said some years ago or wrote in one of his books, that all his friends who exercise a lot are having to replace their knees and their hips and things like that, and he's not going to do that because he's not going to subject his body to all that stress. He's not going to burn through it. And So exercise is like a bad thing because it burns you up. You know, I just think this is weird stuff, right? So what this leads us to is the 25th Amendment. And the 25th Amendment was proposed in 1965, ratified in 67. And while there are some who think that its real genesis, its real origin, went back with the stroke that Woodrow Wilson experienced while he was in office, while he was president, or perhaps with the stroke that killed Franklin Roosevelt when he was president. But it having passed and been ratified in 67 might have had more to do with the assassination of Jack Kennedy. But whatever the genesis of the 25th Amendment, it's basically it replaces the language in the Constitution about presidential secession. And it adds something quite significant. This is Section 4. Whenever the vice president... Now, so this would require Mike Pence. He has to be the lead on this. Whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may by law provide, and there, to the best of my knowledge, is no other body right now, so this would be the cabinet, the leaders of the executive offices. Whenever the vice president, a majority of the principal officers of the executive departments transmit to the president pro tem of the Senate, who I think is Orrin Hatch, and the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who's Paul Ryan, their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office of acting president. So the vice president, if the vice president can get the majority of the cabinet to sign a piece of paper saying Trump is not fit for office, then Mike Pence becomes president. Now, thereafter, if the president, now see, again, this was probably envisioned for strokes and heart attacks. Eisenhower had a heart attack in his last year in office, too, in 1959. So, you know, who knows? But anyhow, but I think you can apply it to mental incapacity. Thereafter, when the president transmits to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House his written declaration that no inability exists. In other words, hey, I've recovered from my stroke, said Woodrow Wilson, kind of thing. He shall resume the powers and duties of his office unless the vice president and the majority of either the principal officers of the executive branch or the such body as Congress may provide transmit within 4 days to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Basically, their challenge, their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. If the Congress, within 21 days after receipt of the latter written declaration, determines by a two-thirds vote of both houses that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president basically becomes the president. So basically, you know, Pence and the cabinet could do this. If Trump fights back against it, Pence and the cabinet have to send another letter to Congress. Congress has 4 days to respond to this and to vote on it, and it takes a two-thirds vote of the House and Senate. So the bar is like super, super high here, particularly with the Republicans in charge of the House and Senate. But is it time to start talking about the 25th Amendment?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And if so, what is the basis of that? Is it the specific behaviors? Hey, this guy is passing out, you know, classified information. Or is it what's behind them? Hey, this guy's going crazy. And welcome back. Merlin in Madison, Wisconsin, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Merlin, what's up?
Hi, I'm turning off my speakerphone.
Thank you.
Hi, my comment goes to all of the above. I have called my representatives, and I urge other viewers, listeners to do the same, and urge them to bring up this issue on the floor of Congress so that it is so deeply embedded in the congressional record, the Republicans won't be able to pull it out with the forceps. It's there. It's for history to see. It cannot be denied. It has to be done. The other thing is his behavior is so erratic, and this goes to the 25th Amendment, that he's presenting a clear and present danger to the security of the United States and its people.
Yeah, and it's not just, you know, Kislyak and Lavrov. I mean, he's looking at North Korean top secret documents at Mar-a-Lago in front of the guests who are taking pictures on their iPhones of it.
Yep. Yep. You know? It's all there. It's the record is there in the public domain, but it also has to appear in the congressional record.
Yeah.
This is historical. You know, we're having our second Tuesday constitutional crisis in a row. And it's got to be stopped. The other thing I think is...
Hang on, if I may, Merlin, you said we're having our second Tuesday constitutional crisis in a row.
Yes.
I don't know what you're talking about. Could you clarify?
Well, last Tuesday, he fired the man who's investigating him.
Ah, yeah, okay. I was out of the country.
And
I'm sorry.
It dropped yesterday. It's out of sequence a little. But, you know, it's got to be stopped. The Republicans won't do it, and they have to be forced to the brink. And perhaps this is one of those methods that will do it. I think he will also seek litigation if he is if articles of impeachment are drawn up.
Yeah,
he will drag that through the courts. This is probably quicker and dirtier than that.
One of the Washington Post columnists, and forgive me, I caught this on the fly this morning as Louise and I were getting up and brushing my teeth and all this other kind of stuff. And so I frankly don't remember who it was. There were four or five people sitting at the table with Joe Scarborough, and we were just kind of watching it as we were getting ready to head in here to the radio studio. And although I think it might have been Eugene Robinson. But in any case, he kind of jokingly said, what if we just offered him $1 billion to go away? And, because I think he's going to fight any kind of removal. I think the Republicans will support him in that. And yet, I think the Republicans would very much like him to go away. He's becoming a problem. He's becoming a distraction. He is not a conventional Republican. He's a Democrat when it comes to trade, which has got the Republicans very upset. He's a Democrat, or at least campaigned as one, when it comes to Social Security. And in fact, he forced Paul Ryan to pull a cut of Social Security out of the budget that they just did, although he allowed a cut for Medicare and Medicaid. But nonetheless, they're just, they're not happy with him. They'd like Mike Pence. They'd like a reliable toady, a guy who will, when the billionaires say jump, Mike Pence will say how high. Donald Trump is one of the billionaires, so he's just not used to doing that. And
he understands the language of money. So maybe Robinson has a very.
Yeah, if it was Eugene Robinson. So, the idea of saying, hey, here's $1 billion, go away, as opposed to we won't prosecute you if you go away. I mean, he doesn't seem to deal well with threats. But bribes, I think he knows bribes really well. He's said in the past that he's had to give bribes in foreign countries in order to do business. So, Merlin, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call. It's very thought-provoking stuff. I appreciate it. Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and Carla in Warren, Ohio. Hey, Carla, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was wondering if, I don't care how it happens, Mr. Trump is removed and Pence takes his place, does the Senate lose their tie-breaking vote?
No. Maybe for a few days. But what Pence would do is appoint a vice president. And that vice president would be, I believe, ratified by the Senate. I'd have to go back and read the Constitution or ask somebody who knows this stuff. But basically, the new president appoints a vice president, and there is some sort of a ratification process, which presumably would not be, I guess it would depend on who he picked, but I doubt he'd do something, really, really controversial.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm just trying to figure out why. I know they want to do crap before he's gone so they can blame him.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to find motives. Thank you.
Motive,
so
motive for what?
Welcome back.
Thank
motives
you.
For their inaction.
Oh, for the Republican inaction?
Well, the whole crew of them are kind of...
You mean inaction around Trump?
Yeah. Well, around the whole thing, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, how this could happen and be allowed to go on.
Yeah, it really is confounding in a way. And I personally believe the Republicans in office who are dancing to the tunes of the billionaires, which is probably well over 90% of them, are so eager to get to the tax cut part of this, so eager to get to the where the real money is, right? Both the money that they're going to get kicked back to them and for their campaigns, and the money for the donors who own them. They're so eager to get to that that they're willing to put up with just about anything to get there. And they know that Mike Pence is a lousy salesman. I mean, he was a laughingstock as the governor of Indiana. The whole periods for Pence thing, if you're not familiar with it, Google it. It's amazing.
I did hear about it.
Yeah, Mike Pence is a buffoon. And not a particularly competent buffoon at that. And so they're figuring, whereas Trump can marshal the base, you know, he can get the people out on the streets. He can master the optics. He can manipulate the media. And so basically, when you're hearing people like Cornyn and these guys, you know, doing their, oh, I wish he'd just, you know, Mitch McConnell, I wish he'd quit tweeting. You know, what they're really saying is, Donald, shut up for a minute until we can get to the damn tax stuff. After we're done with the tax stuff, after we've paid off the billionaires who put us all in office, then we can have a conversation. You know, that's what I think is going on. So,
I mean, I'm sorry to hear that, but thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Carla. Good to hear from you. But, you know, when the world is led by a child, what do we do? How do we deal with this? Major whistleblowing on Medicare, by the way. I want to get to that in a little bit, too. But there's this whole idea, and I realize I've got a bunch of calls here. To those of you on hold, my apologies. We just have about 30 seconds until we're going to hit a break here, so I don't want to do that to you. But this whole idea that Trump is non-compos menace, that he is mentally incompetent. You know, I'm of two minds about it. On the one hand, it does seem, particularly when you look at the comparisons of his 1980 interviews and his current interviews, that, you know, he has suffered some in the mental department. That does come with age. I mean, we have to acknowledge that. Whether he's like into some kind of full-blown dementia or not, I'm kind of skeptical about that. The thing I'm not skeptical about is that this is a guy who has no core. He has no essential sense of self. He has no belief set that he can articulate. And as such, I think he's scaring the Republicans as much as the Democrats.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
So that said, maybe you've got an idea that I don't. Maybe you've caught something I haven't. We'll pick up your calls after. Welcome to the Tom Hartman University Book Club. We're reading today from What Would Jefferson Do? A Return to Democracy. I'm on page 109. These are the title of the chapter is Myths About Democracy in America. Myth. Left to themselves, people would drain the treasury. Reality. They haven't. To the contrary, conservative administrations have. Conservatives are aggressively promoting the idea that democracy is doomed and should be replaced by an aristocracy of large corporations who already largely control the Republican Party because, they say, people are fundamentally lazy and will drain the treasury simply voting themselves unlimited welfare benefits. This is a slur that is particularly directed against people of color by conservatives in the United States. This myth is especially ironic since the irresponsible fiscal policies of conservative presidents Reagan, George H.W., and George W. Bush mostly created today's budget deficits. Numerous conservative websites promote this myth by quoting Alexander Fraser Tytler, 1747 to 1813, a Scottish politician and historian, who allegedly wrote in 1776, quote, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates, promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been 200 years." End of quote. given that USA is over 200 years old, that's a rather scary quote. The problem is that Lord Teitler had his facts wrong. At the time he wrote the statement, if he did, Bartlesby simply lists it as unverified, only one democracy had existed for more than a few decades, Athens. And its end had nothing whatsoever to do with people voting themselves benefits from the public treasury. In 1776, when the quote was supposedly written, the world's second democracy was just being birthed and wouldn't take full form for another decade, so it seems on its face nonsensical. Similarly, Teitler's description of the way nations with representative governments would fail is accurate only if you're counting those democracies that are corrupted by the wealthy and powerful to the point that they've become sham democracies and, in fact, have become feudal aristocracies where the feudal lords are the wealthy individuals or the powerful corporations. History and the experience of the world's mature democracy shows us clearly that when a majority of people participate in democracy, even simply by voting for the representatives, they don't vote to steal the wealth of the nation from themselves. Another myth. Liberal democratic policies are socialism. The reality? Democracy has nothing to do with collective ownership. Conservative commentators love to roll out this myth when people in a democratic society agree to tax themselves in order to provide for the common good. In fact, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines socialism as any of various economic and political theories advocating collective or governmental ownership and administration of the means of production and distribution of goods, a system of society or group living in which there is no private property, B, a system of condition of society which the stages of production are owned and controlled by the state. So then it goes back to the book. No rational liberal or progressive in America is suggesting any of these things. Have you heard a conservative complain about our socialist police forces or about our socialist fire departments? Of course not. But they're paid for by taxes, or our socialist roads, or our socialist air traffic control system, or, best of all, our socialist military with its strict rules that the highest paid may not make more than 20 times the salary of the lowest paid, its comprehensive free health care system, and its subsidized housing. Indeed, the military might qualify as the most socialist institution in our government, though I doubt they'd like to be called that by conservatives or anyone else. So why do conservatives incessantly apply this label to programs that don't match the definition? It's because the word has such a negative reputation. Socialist and communist nations have, for the most part, been conspicuous failures, killing tens of millions of dissenters in the process. This is as using the word socialist as in the old Union of Soviet Socialist Republics context. Modern democracy is not collective ownership, but a political system in which the voice of the people is not only heard in government, but is the government. The means of production and distribution of goods and services, except those having to do with the commons, like fire and police, should continue to be privately owned. But just as certainly, we the people must take back ownership of our government. This will remove us from Benito Mussolini's vision of a corporate state and leave us in the radical middle place of a constitutionally limited democratic republic, a modern liberal democracy. Myth. Free markets are nature's way of making the winner fit and strong. It's Darwin. Reality. Darwin's method led to more diversity, not less. Conservative activists love to complain about the dangers associated with the concentrated power of government. Indeed, anybody who's ever spent time in the Third World, in dictatorships like the old Soviet Union, or in a repressive communist state like modern-day China, and I've worked in all three, understands how dangerous concentrated and unrestrained government power can be. The real problem, however, arises when there are gross inequalities in the size and difference and power of different entities in a culture. This is true whether the giant party is a powerful government, a powerful corporation, or a vastly powerful individual. In any case, ordinary people can find themselves in trouble without a thing they can do about it, no matter how great the injustice. And it goes on from there. The book is What Would Jefferson Do? A Return to Democracy. Oh, the plot thickens. My pastor now says... Mark Sumner writing about this up at the top of Daily Kos right now. McMaster now says Trump didn't even know where the information came from. Right? He couldn't have disclosed, you know, sources and persons and all that because we never told him. Right? This is mind boggling. You know, the intelligence community has figured out. Don't tell anything to that orange guy in the White House. He's loose lips sink ships and all that kind of stuff. By the way, pleased to welcome WPEK AM in Asheville, North Carolina, now carrying all 3 hours of the Tom Hartman program live starting this week. And thanks so much. It's this is I think our second station, this new station this week. We're picking up stations at the rate of, I don't know, at least 3 or 4 a month. And it's great. It's we're very happy. So to your calls and your thoughts. Nell, speaking of Asheville, Nell from Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Nell, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. And we are so glad you're back on in Asheville.
Yeah, me too.
Love your show. And then you went off and then you came back. And so I'm glad.
Thank you.
As to the discussion about Trump and this information, and you just brought up this thing, he didn't even know where it came from.
Right.
And he didn't even bother to ask before he, you know, loosely lipped this information. I mean, even George Bush was not stupid enough to give information to Putin without asking the intelligence agencies.
Or anybody else, for that matter.
Or anybody else, what exactly it was that he could tell them. Because this involves all of our contacts throughout the world who give us information. They're not going to trust us.
Yep.
With that information, so it impacts us in ways he didn't. His pea brain couldn't even fathom.
Well, I'd say I don't think it's so much that his pea brain, because I don't think he's a stupid man. I think it's that he's desperate for approval. I mean, the part of the transcript that we have is he said, "I get great intel. I get the greatest intel in the world." It's like he was bragging about how much information he has, and then he starts sharing it with guys from another country.
Right. Right. No, there's no doubt that he has an intelligence, whatever, you know, department of intelligence that is.
You don't get to be where he is without at least an IQ of 100.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But he's more concerned about, you know, about, as you said, his own, I'm the greatest.
Yeah, I'm concerned about his emotional maturity.
I'm the best. The other thing is, and this may be just a small point, but can you leak information that is false? I guess you can if you're trying to confound people.
Oh, it's routinely done. It's routinely done.
Yes, it is routinely done. But when the master says, it's the leaks that are, but if those leaks are false, it's not really leaking.
Yeah, it's called disinformation.
Well, yeah. Anyway, that was just a thought I had. But thank you for letting me.
Yeah, I absolutely get what you're saying, Nell, and thank you for welcoming me back to Asheville. The weird thing is, you know, Jack Kennedy understood this concept. You know, he leaked a little false information on occasion, particularly with regard to Castro and the old Soviet Union and LBJ. I mean, there's a lot of examples of this throughout history. In fact, the book that came out about 2 years ago about the Dulles brothers during the Eisenhower era is just mind-boggling in that regard. The sad thing is, and I'm guessing you'll agree with me on this, is that Donald Trump, and again, after just having defended his intellect, Donald Trump probably wasn't smart enough is the wrong phrase, wise enough, wary enough, understanding of politics enough, whatever, to have figured out that it might be appropriate for him to give that, to feed them some BS rather than just give them the real stuff, you know? So,
true,
what do you think?
Too.
Yeah.
That's true, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. What are we doing with this? This is incredible. Nell, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to us. We'll be, we won't be. Let's move on to Eric in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
Well, we have a child POTUS right now.
Mm-hmm. It seems.
And
emotionally, anyway.
It really gets, or I should say, childlike.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I kind of wish that as much as the GOP and the Republicans say they're patriotic and everything, why do they not put country before party and implement the 25th Amendment. Here's another thing. If they can't do that, where's the adult in the room that grabs Trump by the ear, puts him across his knee, and blisters his butt, and then puts him in timeout?
Well,
because that's the way he's acting. That's the way he's acting.
Yeah, if you read Brooks' column, and he's not the only source of this, obviously. There's a number of people who are saying that basically you can't speak back to Donald Trump. His entire life, he has run a kingdom. He has been the king of his own kingdom, and he has always surrounded himself with yes men. I think, having as an entrepreneur, I've started seven businesses in my life. One failed spectacularly. One kind of never went anywhere. You know, five of them we did really well with, and we sold four of them, and the fifth one is this show right now. And I've always been happy to have people who work with me or for me or who advise me say to me, you know, that's probably not a good idea, or you ought to do it this way, or you made a huge mistake there, Tom. And I try to give people space to do that. And apparently Trump is so insecure that he will only allow yes men around him. And I think that's why he's been so vulnerable to these get rich quick schemes like Trump University, Trump vodka, Trump steaks, you know, you name it, that failed because somebody came in and said, hey, here's an idea. He thought, oh, that's a great idea. He turned to all of his advisors and said, what do you think? And they were all afraid to say that. That's idiotic. You know, you ought to stick to your core business of real estate. What are you doing making steaks?
You're exactly right. Yes.
And the same thing is happening in the White House. He's got everybody scared to death. And there are adults in the White House, but none of them are willing to risk their lives or their careers anyway, by behaving like adults. The great hope was his daughter Ivanka might be able to do that, but she doesn't seem to be, having any influence on him. And in fact, increasingly, it's seeming like she just published this book about, you know, how to be a working woman and, you know, big, great advice on how to deal with your nanny and your team, you know, your chef and the people who drive your kids to school, your chauffeur and stuff like that. I mean, come on. It's like so out of touch. I think there's no adults in the room. And it's a major problem for all of us.
Sure. So. You're exactly right. All the years that I spent in the military, I did 27 years, and it's like I started at the bottom. I came up to pretty well the top. And I would say with him, it's his narcissistic attitude, and because he can do no wrong, and his followers, as I call them leanings, is... they scare me because they remind me of the family.
Mm. You mean Charlie Manson's family?
No, the family from Charles Manson.
Yeah.
Because he could do no wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's scaring the heck out of me.
That analogy is a little harsh, but because I think that the people around him actually realize that he's doing wrong. I don't think that they deify him the way that Squeaky Fromm deified Charles Manson. But they are scared to death of him. And the other thing is that he's demanding loyalty of people, but he has never in his life been loyal to another person, as far as anybody can tell. Once you're no longer convenient or useful to him, or he perceives any kind of slight, he will not only drop you like a hot potato, he will stomp on you and destroy you. And people know that. People have known that throughout his business career. It's one of the tools that he's used to get what he wants. It's this kind of mafia-like attitude that you see among some developers, real estate developers, particularly in cities that have a lot of mob influence like New York City. And you know, that kind of mentality, that's dangerous stuff, frankly, in the White House. And it's something that, you know, Now the question that was asked, perhaps it was the previous caller, you know, why doesn't Pence and the majority of the cabinet sign that letter and start this process of the 25th Amendment of removing him? If they're one person short, Donald Trump is going to fire all of them in 5 minutes and institute lawsuits against them. And stop. You know, it's like they're looking at career-ending, damaging stuff. They're scared.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, there are fewer places. If somebody offered me a job in the Trump administration right now, I would turn it down, not just because of the politics, but just bizarro. And welcome back, Suzanne in Brunswick, Georgia. Hey, Suzanne, what's on your mind?
Hey,
thanks for watching Free Speech.
Just a couple of quick points. I think that those two Russian guys that met with Trump in the White House, I think that was Putin's way of telling the world that he is now in the White House. The other thing is I think that he's meeting with these other dictators is because I believe that he's giving them all that secret information in lieu of them forgiving his loans, because I think the information to these people are far more important than the loans that they have given Trump over the years. And I also think those two Russian guys in the White House were also giving messages to Trump from Putin, and like the old mob days, don't do it through the phone. Don't do it through email. Do it face-to-face, and that's very scary. Your thoughts?
Except that there were people in the room with them who did hear what was said, and there was a transcript made of the conversation. And in fact, there are people now, elected officials, who are saying, please delete from the transcripts so it never makes it into the record, the confidential information that he passed out. Number one, I don't think this has to do with loans. Frankly, with regard to Trump's loans and his business practices, I'm not so concerned about his association with foreign governments like, Turkey and Germany and Turkey and Russia and who's the other oligarch he's sucking up to? Oh, the Philippines, Duterte, because I don't think that it's government to business stuff that's going on. I think it's organized crime to business stuff or oligarchs to business stuff. And I think he's trying to hide his associations with some of these very, very wealthy people who are basically kleptocrats, and in a number of countries, including Russia. But that's just my speculation. It's the best reason I can come up with that, and the fact that he doesn't want to admit that he's nowhere near as rich as he says he is about why he won't release his tax returns. Putin did request this meeting in the White House with Kislyak and Lavrov. And in his telephone conversation with Trump, a few days ago, but I think it was my sense of it is that this is more a matter of national pride and prestige, and I think that Donald Trump, in his kind of childlike way, and in this regard, I'm not actually speaking as an insult, because I think Reagan did the same thing, and Reagan was probably on the edge of his dementia at the time when he was negotiating with Gorbachev. And you'll remember Reagan sat down and said, let's try to create a world with no nuclear weapons at all. And Gorbachev said, okay, let's do that. And out of that came a historic arms reduction treaty. And, so I think that there's a part of Trump that thinks that, okay, Russia's the other big nuclear power. They got, 7,000-8,000 nuclear weapons. We've got 10,000-12,000, whatever. We need to coexist with these guys. And that's not an unreasonable argument to make, but it's not turning out that way. It's like he's being played or something. And of course, there's political forces in the United States that frankly don't want anything like that to turn out that way. So I think this is Suzanne, I think that there are layers within layers of complexity here, that whenever we try to reduce it to a simple, good guy, bad guy, this guy, that guy. We miss that nuance to our own disadvantage. But I think you're onto some interesting points here, Suzanne. Thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ed, Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Tom, I think you people don't get it. He's in charge. If he says something is no longer classified, it's no longer classified. Nobody can argue with that.
Oh, I pointed that out in the first 5 minutes of this show, Ed.
Okay. Well, then, like, he's in charge. If you weren't in the military, I don't think you understand what that means. It means if a first lieutenant who's 22 years old and you're a sergeant that's 25 or 30 tells you to do it, you do it.
Right. So what does that have to do with anything?
Well, that's Trump. The man is in charge, and if he says black is white, then that's what you have to salute and say, yes, sir, black is white.
Well, see, my reading of the Constitution, Ed, is that the president is not the king. That the president is the head of one of three co-equal branches of government that serve to check and balance each other and that are all under the power of, responsive to, the people. That ultimately, in a democracy or a republic, if you prefer to call it that, that it wouldn't be a republic if the people weren't in charge. So, yeah, Trump has certain powers. He's the commander in chief of the armed forces. He has, you know, some powers with regard to things like executive orders. He can direct his executive branch agencies to do certain things. You know, he's trying to blow up women's rights around the world, you know, stuff like this. I mean, he can do those things. But that doesn't mean that he's absolutely in charge. I mean, arguably, if you read the Constitution, and particularly if you read the Federalist Papers and you get the debate and read John Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention in August, September of 1787, they were all absolutely clear and totally unambiguous. The people are supposed to be in charge, although it has to be done through a representative process. And what's happened, in my opinion, Ed, is that the people have lost charge, that we've got a couple of political parties that have been dancing, the Republican Party dancing to the top 1%, the Democratic Party dancing to the top maybe 10 to 30%, you know, the professional class and things, and that the bottom class has been just kind of left out. The Democratic Party has been trying to reach out to them, but the, you know, the Republican Party's, you know, assault on the unions and Fox and everything else, I mean, it has gotten trampled. And what we need to do is get back in charge. But right now, because of these Supreme Court decisions that started with the Buckley case in 76 and Boston versus Bilotti in 78 and then Citizens United in 2010, McCutcheon in 2013, all these cases, what they've done is they have put not the people in charge of our government, not the people in charge of selecting who our president and our vice president and our senators and our House members are. They've put the billionaires in charge. And the media that the billionaires own, like Fox News and the right wing talk radio. And that is not, in my opinion, a healthy thing for a democratic republic. Your turn,
well,
Ed.
You know, it's your opinion, but the people have put him in charge and that's it. It's over.
Well, actually, the majority of the people put Hillary Clinton in charge. But you're right. The Electoral College, which was put into place to
protect... We have a corrupt political system, but the corrupt political system put him in charge.
Yeah. So let's uncorrupt... I realize that you and I have very different politics, but can't we agree that it's now an important and useful time to uncorrupt the political system, perhaps by getting money out of it and making it so that the billionaires aren't running the show anymore?
Tom, I think that the best thing we could do would be to make it illegal for any politician to take any money anytime for any reason, and that would fix everything that's wrong with this government.
I'm with you. Ed, we finally agreed on something. Thanks a lot for the call. Carl in Chicago. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Yes, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Yeah, it's time that we just cut to the chase and accept what Donald Trump is. He's an amoral individual, which means that he's mentally deficient. I'm in the defense of the fact of what amoral stands for, and that's Donald Trump. You can't go to, say, like a mental institution and expect to have the patients to be rational. Yeah.
In other words, it goes beyond immorality. It's not that he's bad or evil. It's that he is so unaware of the concept of morality that he's sometimes moral and sometimes immoral, and it doesn't matter because he doesn't know the difference. Therefore, he's amoral. He has no morality.
That's what I'm saying. He is amoral. He doesn't know. That makes him mentally deficient. I mean, it'd be like me, Tom, saying, well, hey, I'm going to put my life in your hands, knowing, however, that you don't care whether you live or die.
Yeah, not a good thing to do.
This is Republicans' problem now. they think that their self-preservation is dependent upon them preserving Donald Trump, when that's the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, you even said today, your own self, that, well, oh, he doesn't care about the Republican Party. He doesn't care about no one. He doesn't care about this country. He only cares about Donald Trump. Yep. And when you we have to just get down and accept it and recognize that, well, that's what this guy represents. There's no rational, you know, rationalizing his behavior or anything like that. This is what he is. And impeachment is where we got to go with this. I don't know about removing him by the 25th Amendment, but there's enough there to impeach him once the Republicans accept it. Well, oh, he doesn't care about nobody.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's starting to sink into their little brains. But they're still addicted to the billionaire money, which, and keep in mind, this guy was part of the Koch network for years and years, and he's one of the billionaires. So there's this kind of weird, incestuous stuff going on inside the Republican Party. Carl, I got to move along, but thanks for your comments. Very well said. James, in Utah, Alabama, am I saying that right?
Yes, sir, you are. You got it right.
What's up, James? Thanks for listening to Sirius XM.
I spent 37 years in the military. And what nobody's looked at, somebody that don't like Donald Trump, that working in Washington D.C., they could start a rumor mill, and they heard he was going to meet with the Russians, and they just called the Washington Post and said, hey, this is what's going on. Well, you know, people print anonymous sources, so you could be looking at just a rumor mill. We had a guy in the military did that.
But he tweeted this morning, James, that he actually did what the Washington Post said he did.
That's what I'm saying. It's a rumor. I've been saying the guy that called in or the girl that called in that don't like Donald Trump said, hey, he's giving classified information to the Russians. Well, that could be, he could, didn't know what he was talking about, but he, you know, hit the nail on the head. You see what I'm saying?
No, I'm missing something here, James.
People call, we had guys in the military used to start a rumor all the time.
Right.
And this guy or girl don't like Donald Trump.
You're talking about the authors of the Washington Post people? Peace?
No, did he get anonymous tip from somebody, a leaker?
No. Yeah. The Washington Post piece came out of two people who were inside the White House, inside the Oval Office, when that meeting happened, who were not willing to have their names used in the newspaper, but their identities were verified by the Washington Post by multiple sources. And It's a solid story. And Trump basically this morning came out and said, yep, I did it. And this is after sending, you know, three of his spokespeople out to say, no, he didn't, which is really hanging your people out to dry, which would give me pause about ever being anything close to the Trump administration.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.